knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, California, and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. And we're available via podcast, either through iTunes, where you can go to our public radio page and scan down to KUCI, or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view prior guests, upcoming interviews, and access our archives to past shows. They're up there now and available to you 24 hours a day for free. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Barbara will be here with you next week. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world. This morning I'm joined by Judith Thurman, and coming up in the second half hour, Christina Baldwin will be here, so please stay with me for that. Judith Thurman began contributing to The New Yorker in 1987 and became a staff writer in 2000. She writes about fashion and books, and her subjects have included André Malraux, Elsa Schiaparelli, and Cristobal Balenciaga. Judith is the author of Isaac Dennison, The Life of a Storyteller, which won the 1983 National Book Award for Nonfiction and served as the basis for Sidney Pollack's movie, Out of Africa. She also wrote Secrets of the Flesh, A Life of Colette, winner of the LA Times Book Award for Biography and the Salon Book Award for Biography. But it's her collection of New Yorker essays, Cleopatra's Nose, published by Farrar Straus, that we'll be discussing this morning. Judith, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, there's such a mystique surrounding the New Yorker and those who have managed to sort of scale the walls and write for the New Yorker. And I wanted to begin with your beginnings, how you came to the magazine and whether or not that was a sort of conventional path.
Well, actually, you know, I write about this a little bit in the introduction. My family had a peculiar relation to the magazine. My grandfather was a Hungarian baker at the turn of the century in New York, and Ralph Fleischman, who was the first publisher of the New Yorker, was sent by his father to apprentice with my grandfather to sort of learn the ropes of baking from the ground up. And when my mother was 16, my grandfather was not a cultivated man. He was a working-class artisan, really. He and Ralph Fleischman had become friends, and he said, "Fleischman, do you think there's something for Alice at your magazine? She'd like to be a receptionist." So she got a summer job there at 16, and she was sort of starstruck by the magazine, by the literary world. She went on to earn a degree in English, and she sort of imbued this sort of the New Yorker mystique in me from a very early age. But I actually think that's not so unusual. Almost every young writer I know aspires to sort of scale the heights. It's kind of like the Potala, you know, the Tibetan palace on the hill. you know, how do you get up there? By mule or rope? And it was not until I had published Dinnison, which won the National Book Award, that I dared actually approach the New Yorker and suggest very timidly that I might like to do some book reviewing for them. And Robert Gottlieb was then the editor, and he was very receptive, and he said, "Sure, come on over." And the first piece that he assigned to me was terrifying to me. It was a review of a novel by Nadine Gordimer, who was a writer I revered. The problem was I didn't think it was a particularly good, strong Gordimer novel, so I was faced with this, for me as a young writer, terrible quandary of how to do her justice and at the same time do critical justice.
Interesting. And it's interesting also in the introduction, I think you mentioned that you're surprised you ended up in nonfiction, and you know, perhaps it's not entirely suited to your personality.
No, it's not. I'm a sort of dreamy person. I find it very hard to focus. I've tried outlining. I've tried sort of approaching nonfiction in a very irrational way, the way some of my colleagues do. I remember once meeting Louis Menand, whose nickname is Luke, at a dinner party on a Friday night, and I said, "What are you working on?" He said, "Oh, something about metaphysicals and this and that, and a very complicated philosophical piece." And I said, "Oh, well, when is it due?" He said, "Monday." I said, "Luke, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, I have the entire weekend." And I sort of panic, and I it takes me a very long time to drill through the shale of what I like to call the shale of my stupidity to reach the sort of the intelligence or the sort of perceptiveness that a New Yorker piece needs. I started out as a poet, and that was doable. I mean, you can sort of write 10, 15, 20 lines in the course of 3 weeks. Struggling with it. It's a short tunnel with you can sort of see the light at the end. But these big books that I undertook, that I kind of fell into, were really not, didn't feel congenial to my nature.
Interesting. And there's a lot in that that I want to talk about and unpack. But I was curious as to whether the magazine has changed much in the 20 years that you've been writing for them, or if you feel the readership has changed, or kind of the state of literacy and literary pieces in the United States.
Well, the magazine has changed a lot. I think Gottlieb was a transitional figure in the magazine from the Shawn era, the era of William Shawn, through the era of Tina Brown to the era of David Remnick. And every New Yorker editor, it's sort of like a kingship in a way. Each one, there's the Victorian age, the Edwardian age, the Remnick age, et cetera, et cetera. And each one sort of brings a personality and a culture to the magazine. And Gottlieb came from publishing, sort of literary publishing, and he was, you had a great deal of time and latitude to write a piece. It wasn't particularly pegged to a news item, to something in the current. I mean, I was assigned a piece on a film called Walker by Alex Cox, and by the time I managed to go to Nicaragua, report the piece, come back, the film had come and gone. That would never happen today. David comes from the news world. He's a great reporter, and he brings a kind of daily, a sense of the daily happening, current events, you know, very much sort of a shorter, more factual attitude to literary journalism. It's still very literary, however. One of the great privileges of working there is this extraordinary editorial fact-checking and copy-editing staff who keep you to the strictest standards of prose writing. And for a perfectionist, I mean, that's a great luxury. It's a painful luxury, but it's a great luxury.
Yeah, absolutely. That's interesting.
I still think there's a great, perhaps underestimated pool of lovers of the word who, of all ages, I mean, it used to be the New Yorker has gotten, I think, younger and younger, and certainly the staff has gotten younger. But I, you know, it's still, there's still an audience for that kind of very, very first-rate writing.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, I hope so.
I think so. I think it's maybe shrinking. I mean, you sort of look at the bestseller list and you think, oh my God, and you look at the articles and magazines. I mean, when I was doing a catalog essay for a book by Richard Avedon, I went back into the old Harper's Bazaar fashion magazines from the 40s and the 50s, and they were publishing fantastic literary fiction by great writers. That doesn't happen anymore. So things have gotten sort of beyond this pot de la palace. I mean, the world of popular culture has perhaps declined in its attention or its the reverence that's paid to writing, but I think there's still an enormous amount of it.
Yeah. You know, there's so much to talk about in this collection, so we should dive into it. Perhaps you can introduce us to Cleopatra's Nose, kind of the origins of the collection and how these 39 essays came together for you.
Well, you know, I wanted to sort of have my work in one place. I think the two biographies took 7 and 8 years, respectively, but the journalism in the course of 20 years was a major part of my writing life, and I sort of thought it would be nice to have it in between two covers. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Galassi, who's a very old friend, I mean, we sort of knew each other almost from college days, it felt like sort of coming home to go to Farrar Straus. But he said, I think very wisely, he said, look, a collection of essays needs a theme. You just don't sort of shuffle a bunch of essays together and put them in a book. So find the theme. Pick the essays and find the theme. And it was very interesting for me to go back, really. There's a lot of things lots of pieces that were excluded from the book. And as I was rereading the work, I realized that really the theme of desire is present. Desire in all of its guises is really present in all of these essays. The desire to reinvent yourself, hunger, lust, escape, as well as various forms of creative ambition.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of was my organizing principle. And then when it came to the title, the Cleopatra essay, which is the last essay in the collection, was always sort of, I always had in mind to make that the title essay, but the essay was called The Queen Herself. And as someone pointed out, well, that was going to go straight to the gay studies section of bookstores. So let's find something else. So working with Cleopatra, I went through Cleopatra's Needle, and I didn't quite understand what that meant. And something about Cleopatra's Nose, which is a phrase from, comes from a pensée by Pascal, appealed to me, especially when I went back to my college pensée, the edition, the little sort of moldering purple and beige edition of the book, because he was an evangelical moralist, but he was fascinated with vanity and corruption and with many of the subjects that I actually write about at The New Yorker. And Pensées is, in a way, a meditation on human vanity that exists to persuade a very sophisticated worldly reader that God exists. I'm not trying to persuade anybody that God exists, but in a way, you know, the God of style, I'm trying to persuade people that perhaps, you know, that he, she, it exists.
Mm.
And so there was a sense of affinity.
Wonderful. Yeah, you know, I was also thinking about the collection, and there's so many subject matters covered here. You know, there's the kind of the tradition of tofu making and all the way to Marie Antoinette and Anne Frank and so many subject matters. And they certainly unite under the principle of desire. And I was also thinking they kind of unite under the principle of things that are hidden and not revealed. And, you know, I think you alluded to this in your introduction by entitling it Hide and Seek. And, you know, from your discussion of pearls, you know, kind of the literal hidden gem to New York row houses, and the appeal of New York row houses is that there's kind of this promise of something mysterious happening behind these walls.
And yes, definitely.
It keeps the secret. And I was wondering if that appealed to you as well, if there's something about these subject matters that, although they seem obvious superficially that maybe we would know about them, there's, you know, some hidden thing within them.
You know, that's very perceptive. I like that, actually. It's as much the theme as desire is. I didn't think about it that way, but it's true. And I guess as a biographer, I'm interested in the secrets of people's lives. The Secrets of the Flesh was the title of the Colette book. And the biography of Dinesen is she also encoded her life in her tales. And I think really decryption is part of the biographer's task, and it's also part of the critic's task. It's to find the meaning that isn't obvious in a work of art or in a character, and perhaps also the meaning that isn't obvious to the writer, and to illuminate that for the reader. And I think that's also to make something real, to make a character real. To give it reality on the page, the subject reality on the page, so that the reader can experience it in a visceral way. Yes, I think that's very much part of it, to find the not obvious aspect of the subject. And there's the moment you strive for is that what journalists call vulgarly the gotcha moment, but in sort of more literary journalism, the I see you moment. And I think it's also something that people look for in love, to be seen.
And I'm wondering in some of these essays, was the magic nugget known to you before you started in, and is that how you chose it, or was it usually revealed to you as you were getting deeper and deeper into the subject that you've already chosen?
Nothing is ever revealed to me at the beginning. I never know what it is that I want to say until, in fact, I've written the sentence, usually after a lot of headbanging, that reveals to me what, in fact, I feel about it, what, in fact, is there. And how I get there, I don't know. It's really a dark wood, and you just have to kind of keep following random paths until you find the beginning of the way out. In every case, that's been true. I never really know. It's always a question of digging. There's usually a buried dialectic. There are two sort of opposite poles between which the energy flows of a subject, and when you can find that and articulate it, you're on your way to decoding the subject. But it's a real struggle. I love the image of the Shawshank Redemption. That's the film. That's sort of one of my working metaphors: tunneling through a brick wall with a fork for 25 years or so until you sort of emerge in the light.
Beautiful. I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Judith Thurman, author of Cleopatra's Nose, 39 Varieties of Desire. I'm wondering if you can read to us now and kind of introduce our listeners to this world, and then we can take it from there.
Well, I thought I would actually read something from the introduction, which I think speaks to the things that we've been saying. There are many ways for a woman to be lost or to lose herself, and the subject has become one of my specialties. The first of my lost women was my mother, Alice, who was born two blocks from the Yorkville brownstone where I've raised my son. She was generally as unconfiding about herself as a fugitive, which in a way she was, the fugitive from a life she might have lived. But there was one episode in her youth that she liked to recall, particularly when I had poured her a second glass of sweet sherry and we were sitting at her immaculate kitchen table in Queens under the fluorescent light. Quite apart from the story, the pleasure that it gave her, and her pleasures were rare enough, left a potent impression. And here I will skip a little bit because this is the story of Alice's connection to The New Yorker. Alice was the dormouse in a family that loved drama. A Catholic daughter with the same temperament might have dreamed of the convent. Alice put her faith in the efficacy of silent worry on everyone's behalf. She devoured her father's kipful of Viennese croissant as voraciously as she read her brother's books and mutely retreated to the fire escape from household storms. Her younger sister, Charlotte, a tomboy with Titian hair, once bashed Alice over the head with a violin. "I just got fed up with her goodness," my aunt told me 70 years later. At 16, however, Alice sloughed her cocoon of flesh and emerged from her fatness as a shapely girl whose loveliness was both sensuous and fragile. There is something about her enigmatic smile in old photographs, behind dark glasses, or at the beach in a jersey bathing suit and a striped turban, which suggests that she enjoyed her effect on men. Her decorative stint as a temporary receptionist in the New Yorker's hallowed premises on West 43rd Street led, after she graduated from Hunter, to her employment as a fashion forecaster at Condé Nast. She could never explain exactly what she did beyond spending a fortune on hats and going to the theater and the opera during intermissions, where she made notes on whatever trends in fashion she could discern, which were transferred to color-coded punch cards and analyzed by a mechanical sorting machine at the office. This fantastical interlude, Rube Goldberg meets Dorothy Parker, ended with the Depression, when Alice was rather less glamorously employed teaching English and Latin to the rowdy boys in a South Boston high school. By the time I was old enough to take stock of my mother's character, she had reverted to the habits, the furtive eating and daydreaming of her girlhood. Having once been vain of her complexion, she showed a vain indifference to its ravages, which gave her a resemblance to the old Auden. After one of her periodic bouts of starvation dieting, she bought some pretty clothes, and a rich sister-in-law gave her a Dior hand-me-down that she wore to PTA meetings, but eventually it went the way of her resolve. I knew her mainly as a semi-recluse in a shabby house dress who read with a pencil in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Smoking was probably her greatest indulgence, followed by order, solitude, lists, foul weather, crosswords, and grammar. And the grammarian was a martinet. Alice told me proudly that when Ulysses was first published, she had punctuated Molly Bloom's soliloquy. Until I left for college, my compositions got the same treatment. "You have to admit that it reads better this way," she would say, having mutilated some piece of homework with a pair of scissors. The first time that I received a galley, the essay on Nadine Gordimer in this volume, corrected by the late Eleanor Gould, the New Yorker's formidable chief copy editor, it felt as though my maternal nemesis had come back to haunt me. The margins were almost a work of art, every inch finely tattooed with wispy hieroglyphs like the feet of a Moroccan bride. So I took out my mother's old primers, Longmans, Fowler, Strunk and White, and vowed to make Miss Gould pay Alice, if not me, her most grudging compliment, a clean proof. Alice was over 40 when I was born, and as she needed to become invisible for long stretches, she was fortunate to have produced a placid only daughter who could distract herself. When I was 8, the age that my grandfather escaped from home, I began to write verse. These sing-song ditties, Alice believed, might one day be of interest to posterity, so she recopied them in her school mom's penmanship into a loose-leaf binder. But then she did something I still can't explain. She wrote half a dozen poems of her own and, like a crooked card sharp, shuffled them into the pack. They parroted my diction, but their artful lightness couldn't have been that of a child who blurts out the little she knows rather than shedding the ballast of too much knowledge to achieve simplicity. "Of course they're yours," she insisted when I questioned their provenance. "You just forgot about them." She may have thought that by producing a false miracle, she could inspire me to perform a true one, though she was, of course, also showing me up, denying it, confounding our identities. And to the degree that I connived in this perverse act of inverted plagiarism, stoking my grandiosity. Young children may be harder to fool than their parents like to think, but they often don't have the courage of their disbeliefs. Disbelief is essential to good writing, which in my experience is a line-by-line combat with self-forgery. In that respect, it is a humble version of Pascal's bet. Can I or can't I, through a feat of style, prove my existence to intelligent skeptics, none more skeptical than I am? but I also write to discover the nature of my affinity with an elusive subject who is only rarely real to herself. Alice's guises continue to surprise me, and some of them, like a chameleon on a leaf, are hiding in these pages.
Mm-hmm. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Judith Thurman reading from her her collection of essays, Cleopatra's Nose, 39 Varieties of Desire. What do you look for when you're choosing a subject matter to write about?
Well, that's also pretty mysterious. I mean, at the New Yorker, sometimes a subject is proposed and you're free to accept it or not, and sometimes you sort of have something you really want to write about and you propose it and it's either accepted or not. There's a mystery that I usually want to solve. There's an attraction that I often can't articulate. In many of my subjects are women, as sort of we've pointed out, and they're women who are lost and are looking to find themselves, and I want to sign on to help that discovery process.
Mm.
Many of them are very powerful women who are angry, who are filled with ambition that is sort of culturally inappropriate or culturally denied them. There's a kind of connivance between me and a subject that isn't clear to me at the beginning but becomes clear in the writing. At the moment, I'm doing a profile of Isabel Toledo, who's an incredibly gifted designer. She doesn't like the word fashion designer. She's a designer, very sculptural, very sort of intuitive and at the same time mathematical designer. And I want to find out what makes her tick, what makes her work.
It's interesting because in a lot of these essays, it feels like there are a lot of things playing against each other. Like, I hate to keep bringing up the tofu, but it was so fascinating to me. But kind of, you know, what we perceive as kind of a bland, food, juxtaposed with this incredible complexity that goes into making it, and Anne Frank and her sexuality that, you know, we don't usually attribute to Anne Frank. And
It's always somehow going against the grain of the received idea and the perceived image of somebody. I like
right.
I like the dissent. I'm actually sort of a closet dissenter in a way, and that's true of the fashion writing because I feel very strongly that fashion has been relegated to the women's pages of social history, and along with the misogyny that's the notion that this is frivolous, this is somehow less dignified or less serious than, quote, traditional male pursuits. There's a sort of feminist act of reclamation. Because fashion or clothing, the self-expression that goes into getting dressed, the self-expression that goes into the creation of clothing, all of the codes, it goes back to the beginning of of humanity. People have been decorating themselves and expressing themselves and choosing or not choosing their wrapper since the Cro-Magnons. In fact, I'm writing about prehistoric cave art also, and it's fascinating to see how important that decoration was.
Mm.
It's always a sort of little voice of dissent against the perception. Anne Frank is the good girl, this sort of angelic victim.
Right.
I think that's really part of the project.
Right. Have there ever been subject matters that you found particularly inaccessible, and how do you find your way into those?
Well, sometimes it's very hard to do justice to an antipathetic subject, someone like Leni Riefenstahl, for example. I wanted to understand. That was also a sort of act of dissent. Riefenstahl, everybody deplores her collaboration with the Nazis, but thinks that she was a genius. And I sort of went back and I sort of looked at all the work and I said, wait a minute, what do you mean a genius? This woman was given on a plate the unlimited budget, unlimited cooperation, unlimited collaboration by the greatest cinematographers and documentary makers. When you actually look at these documentaries, they're technically and superficially very brilliant, but they are missing the prime ingredient of every masterpiece one can think of, which is awe before human weakness. And she celebrates the inhuman Nazi notion of the perfect creature. So I dissented about Riefenstahl's sort of place in the pantheon of great filmmakers, even though, and that went against the sort of feminist canon also. I mean, the feminists have wanted to enshrine Reeve Stahl as one of the great first women directors, but we don't always have to take those received ideas, even received ideas that we might like to believe in, for granted. And it was hard to do subject. It's very hard to do subject to somebody who you don't like, and you have to go through all kinds of stages. You have to examine your own prejudices, and that sort of athletic, muscular self-examination, I think, is pretty healthy.
Fascinating. You know, sadly, we're drawing down on the time here, but I'm wondering if you have any last-minute advice for writers out there, aspiring writers out there, or essayists?
I do. I tell young writers, don't look back, in the sense of you have to get to the end of your first draft before you really know what it is you have to say and what it is you can't say. Because the image of dropping the ballast of too much knowledge is extremely important. It's you can't say everything you know. The more you know, the more you know how little you know. The more you know how much is unsayable, and you get trapped by. You get trapped by too much rewriting. And this is something I probably practice in The Breach more than The Observance. Lock up your first draft, keep plowing ahead, and only when you have a finished first draft, go back. That's really the best advice I can give the young.
Great advice. Judith, thanks for taking the time this morning.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Christina Baldwin, so please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Planetary Radio is public radio's only weekly series about space exploration. I'm Matt Kaplan, and I hope you'll join me as we explore Mars, look for life in the universe, and fly through the rings of Saturn. We'll talk with the men and women, scientists and dreamers who are guiding us to a future beyond Earth. And don't forget to enter our weekly space trivia contest. That's Planetary Radio, Mondays at 5:30 p.m. right here on KUCI.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you again next week. Christina Baldwin is an eloquent and witty speaker and educator who integrates the spiritual journey and the practice path in her retreats and workshops. She's taught nationally and internationally since the mid-1970s and has contributed classic books in the emerging bodies of knowledge around personal writing, group process, and spirituality. Her first work, One-to-One, Self-Understanding Through Journal Writing, is a pioneering text that has remained in continuous print for a quarter of a century. Its sequel, Life's Companion, Journal Writing as a Spiritual Quest, extended the art of journal writing to spiritual practice. In the early 1990s, Baldwin began developing a group process methodology that led to concepts presented in her groundbreaking work, Calling the Circle, The First and Future Culture. This book has introduced thousands of people to a practical, hands-on structure for convening their meetings in circle and tapping collective wisdom. She's taken this work to the heart of mainstream culture in North America, Europe, and Africa. This morning we'll be talking about her latest book, Story Catcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story, published by New World Library. Story Catcher's hardcover edition won the Books for a Better Life Awards motivational category in 2006. It's a story-based, passionate call for humanity to hang on to its voice, its love of reading and writing, and its understanding that story is our soul. Christina, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, quite an introduction. You've been so prolific and so hard at work for so long. I'm wondering if you can talk for a moment, if you will, about the personal writing movement, what it is, what it does, how it serves the person in the community.
You know, I'm 60 years old, and it's really amazing that this has pretty much happened in that lifespan. Mm-hmm. That when I was in high school and college, as far as I know, there were only like three people that kept a journal. There was Anne Frank, which was required reading in eighth grade. There was references in American history to the journals of Lewis and Clark. And then when I went to Europe in my mid-20s, I discovered Anaïs Nin, which was just translated and available in England at the time. And I came back in the early 70s to the U.S., and realized, I just began to realize, you know, this little thing that I'm kind of doing off to the side in the corner, telling my life to myself, it could be part of something bigger. But I just thought maybe it was four or five of us.
Wow.
And, you know, at that time, maybe it was. But I went to the University of Minnesota Extension Program because I lived in Minneapolis at the time, and I sort of confessed that I did this activity of writing a journal and asked if they had any classes on it because I didn't know if I was doing it correctly. And they said, well, how long have you been doing it? And I said, well, 10 years. They said, you're the teacher. And that was amazing. I mean, here I was, 24 years old, and looking for guidance. And so I put out this little shingle and said, journal writing class, 8 weeks, and 12 people showed up. And, you know, that class was archetypal because it was 10 women and 2 men, which is often that kind of gender percentage in my classes. And we had 12 poets, I mean, 11 poets, and an antiquarian book dealer.
Mm. Wow.
And what I learned through this man, James Cummings, is he had a collection stashed in his house, floor to ceiling, of over 100,000 first editions of diaries and journals. And he took me to his place and showed me this collection, and it just, something happened. You know, it's like you walk into the total gestalt of it all, and you go, you know, people are compelled to write their life stories. Ordinary people. And so he would say, and here's the Victorian era, and here's what men were writing, what women were writing. And, of course, women were compelled to write about men and how wonderful it was to be married to some lieutenant in India or something, you know. But it really opened up my eyes to the idea that every person's life is a story. And the first line of my book, Story Catcher, is every person is born a blank page and dies a full book.
Mm. It's interesting because I would imagine that those archives would be a treasure trove for fiction writers. You know, that you could, you know, take those diaries and real life experiences from other times and just have a heyday.
Well, and I think that people do. And sometimes fiction writers will even acknowledge that they came across a letter or a fragment of something or a diary or journal, and it did exactly that kind of thing for them. It just opened up a period of time. It also allows historical fiction writers to go back and get a sense of the language use. I was just talking to the Genealogy Society where I live the other day, and and said that one of the things that must be fascinating when they look at old family letters, et cetera, is to see the use of language change through the time period that they have paperwork for.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you had mentioned somewhere in the book, I kind of forget where it was, about where we can find some of these diaries and journal entries. They're in libraries, is that right?
Well, the ones that are published are often in libraries, but the biggest cache that I've ever come across is in the state and county historical societies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is. Then you walk in and you see the history of where you live.
Right, too. Right. What a great resource.
Yeah.
So tell us about Storycatcher, how the book came to be, and how it differs from some of the other works that you've done in the past.
Well, I think it's actually it's kind of the synthesizer of all the work that I've done in the past, in that I started off my career talking about journal writing, and I realized that in the first 15 years or so of working with people, I never had anyone read in class at all, because that generation, particularly the women in that generation, absolutely needed a private place, and that they could come and dare to put down on paper what was going on in their own kind of vague sense of what am I supposed to be, how am I supposed to be. And it's hard to explain to younger women, you know, women sort of the 45 and under right now, how much silence surrounded my generation in the first couple of decades when we were growing up as girls, and probably until just right about 30 when feminism just kind of went poof and detonated everything.
Mm-hmm.
But that somebody said, well, like, what kind of words couldn't you say? And I said, well, everything that's on TV right now. Well, you know, we never talked about who drank. We never talked about incest. We never talked about abuse. We never asked the question, are you happy in your marriage? I mean, it was just this really closed down thing. And there's a chapter in the book called It Was a Dark and Stormy Night, in which I talk about that turning point at the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s in which society took the lid off story.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, when I look back at the 60s, that is really what happened there, is that the lid came off our social story. So we stopped being Ozzie and Harriet and started dealing with ourselves as a multicultural, diverse, complex society that had many different stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm curious about resistance. I think one of the biggest obstacles to any writing, including personal journal writing, is some form of resistance, facing the blank page. And there's just this built-in terror whenever we sit down to write. Not, you know, almost anything else seems more appealing. You know, my refrigerator's never been cleaner since I started writing. How do we get beyond that to force ourselves to kind of confront the white page?
Well, the white page or the blank screen, because I have a lot of people now that bring laptops to class.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I do is I myself, and I teach this over and over again, I teach a little 5 to 7 minute exercise I call flow writing, in which I just say, get ready to write. You know, your pen in hand, hands by the keyboard, whatever you're going to do, and close yourself down for a few seconds. Just take a couple of centering breaths, close your eyes, and just breathe in and give yourself the next 5 minutes and say, I'm just going to give myself 5 minutes here.
Mm.
And when you open your eyes, thing that happens is your eyes done something. You know, I have a candle lit on the little table I'm talking to you. And so I open my eyes, I see that candle, and then I just go, oh, light. And I just start and free associate for 5 minutes.
Mm. Yeah, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, the regular host of the show.
Yes, I've seen her book. Yeah. I've got her book on the table when you said penonfire.com. That's who I'm talking to.
Yeah, yeah.
I pulled it right out.
It is. It's a very freeing thing when you feel like you write and you can't stop, and you don't self-edit and you don't critique, and you just let yourself go. It's wonderful. And I should mention, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, but that is very daunting. You know, people say to me, oh, isn't it wonderful? And you look up and you see that 3 or 4 hours have passed. And I go, you know, that almost never happens for me.
Right.
And I envy writers who, like, can get lost and not move for 6 hours at a time. But I'm a very restless person. I'm up, down, getting another cup of tea, checking on the dogs. I mean, it's, you know. So what I do is I set that kitchen timer for 5 minutes. And then I go about my business, and I come back, and I do another 5 minutes and another 5 minutes. And at the end of the week, maybe I have 25-minute entries. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I say to myself is when the buzzer goes off, stop, even if I'm in the middle of a word. And that leaves in me frustration.
Oh, interesting.
And creative tension. And one of the things I've learned over time is that all story proceeds from tension.
Interesting.
And
interesting.
The mind doesn't differentiate between writing and speaking. The mind goes, thank goodness, I've moved that from the inside of myself to the outside of myself, and I saw you catch it. I saw you go, oh, yeah.
Right, right.
And when we're alone with our journals or any other kind of writing project, oh, yeah, occurs between the eye and the hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a closed system, but it's still happening. So I just say, do 5 minutes at a time for a week and make yourself stop and then go back and reread all those little entries and start circling the themes that appear, the storyline that's emerging, and pretty soon you realize that you could do this for 10 minutes every now and then. You could do it for 15 minutes. And so you kind of like ease your way back into having a writing life.
I like it. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, and I'm here with Christina Baldwin talking about Story Catcher, her latest book, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story. And I should also mention that there are a number of wonderful writing exercises included in the book, prompts and ideas that can take us over a lot of these hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
Those are really, you know, wonderful resources to go to when you're stuck. Maybe I'll have you read to us now and kind of take us into the book a bit, and then we can take it from there.
Okay. I'm going to read you something from the first chapter that's a childhood moment that occurs out in Montana. And my grandfather Baldwin was a Methodist preacher and a beekeeper. You know, out in the rural areas, he couldn't, of course, make a living as a minister, and so he kept bees and had a big garden and raised his family that way. So I think this gives you a sense of the book. For decades, a passel of kinfolk changing crews every year would show up for several weeks in August to bring in the honey crop. Grandpa and the uncles would drive out to raid the hives, 500 colonies of bees strategically placed in those irrigated valleys to bring in the pure gold of alfalfa and sweet clover. I grew accustomed to seeing men in long-sleeved canvas shirts and leather gloves, pants cuffs tucked into boots, bee bonnets draped over their heads and buttoned into collars. Every afternoon, the flatbed truck would rumble into the driveway, groaning from the heavy load of hive boxes or supers taken from the hives. Buzzing with drowsy bees still riding on the honeycomb, it would back up to the honey house loading dock. Sweating a combination of man smell and honey, the men hefted the heavy wooden hive boxes into the extracting shed. There they would slice the wax caps off the combs, run the supers through the centrifuge extractor, and warm the honey just enough to make it trickle down troughs through filter screens and into big metal vats. One evening, my grandpa called me into his study with a small glass bottle of honey in his hand. Under the glow of his desk lamp, he spread open the huge old Bible that had been his father's before him. The scent of honey rose from his skin and his clothing, and maybe the Bible itself. "Looky here, Chrissy," he said, holding the cap jar like a magnifying glass over the words. "Our bees make such pure honey you can read right through it." The letters were slightly wiggled, but I could see them. "Isaiah," he said in his hoarse, whispery voice, "that's a good book. Here, read me this." His hands were square with a fleshy palm, the fingers all sinew and big-knuckled, outdoor hands, calloused palms, his fingernail cleaned with a pocket knife at the horse trough where the men sluiced off the dirt of the day before coming in to dinner, pointed to the middle of the page. I stood on tiptoe, balancing myself with my hands on the edge of the roll-top desk. "Isaiah 55:12," I said, just like they began in church. "For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Good, he said. And where he touched my hair, I thought it smelled of honey. And where he touched my heart, there is honey still. Story opens up a space between people that is unbound from the reality we are standing in. Our imaginative ability to tell story and our empathetic ability to receive story can take us anywhere and make it real. In the act of telling story, we create a world we invite others into. And in the act of listening to story, we accept an invitation into experiences that are not our own, and yet they almost seem to be. Story weaves a sense of familiarity. We are simultaneously listening to another's voice and traveling our own memories. We are looking for connectors, making synaptic leaps, linking one variation of human experience to another. You come with me into the glowing light of the tiny farmhouse study, but you also stream through memories of your own childhood, asking, who put honey in your heart?
That was Christina Baldwin reading from her latest book, Storycatcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story, published by New World Library. That was beautiful. I'm wondering how new writers go about finding the nugget in their own story. Sometimes it's difficult to know what the real essence of our own story is, and there's a lot of time and energy spent on kind of extraneous details or, you know, circling around the subject matter. Are there ways to hone in on what the real story is and what we should be focused on in trying to mine our the story of our lives?
Well, practice, practice, practice. But I think when I say that, I think, oh, I remember practicing the piano. And for me, writing practice has never been as onerous. Maybe it's because I love words so much. But to practice for short periods of time, like the little flow writing exercise I was talking about, for me, I often try to take it into a very sensual relation, you know, metaphoric kind of talk to myself on the page. So I think the way to get at the nugget is often through the body, is through the senses, and to, I mean, that little scene, you know, is so full of sensuality. And when I write like that, I have a little post-it note on the corner of my computer screen that just says taste, touch, sound, feel, smell, you know, and so it's unusual. I thought, I want to go into that scene through smell, through what does honey smell like? You know, when you're walking through the grocery store and you just grab a little plastic bear off the shelf, you don't know that it smells the way it smells.
There's also a lot of alliteration in that packet, or in that passage that you read, and kind of words playing against and off each other, though. It was really beautiful.
Right. So I think for me over time, that's what I've learned, is I can get to the nugget much faster if I go in through my own physical relationship to a memory, to a scene, and if I lose track of the body, then I lose track of the story. I coach a lot of people in writing their stories, and one of my students right now is a woman who was the first highway patrol officer in Wyoming, really broke the gender barrier there, and she has incredibly dramatic moments to tell in her story, and when she reads, I'm just always going, where is your body? This is a dangerous moment. I need to know where your body is as the reader so I know you're going to live.
Interesting.
And so that's what she has over her computer, she tells me, is where is my body, you know? And so I think that kind of discovering, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, is it the sound of someone's voice? Is it where your own body is in relationship to the event? Where are you standing?
Kind of dovetailing on that, you have a wonderful chapter on a spiral of experiences and when traumatic things happen. And how you process those things. And I was hoping you could talk about the spiral of experiences and how to process significant life events to gain insight.
Yeah, I would love to do that. And out on my website, storycatcher.net, there's on the left-hand side all the little bars that open and close and show you things. And the spiral of experiences there and just downloads as a a PDF file, I think it is, in people's computer. So please go out there. But one of this actually, I think, grew out of both my own journal writing and also working with students all those years, but that I realized that the spiral of experience starts when something happens that we pay attention to. You know, there are many dramatic moments in life, but let's just take something. Let's say that, and this can be good news or bad news, but it's a moment of drama that changes our life. So let's say that somebody wakes up one morning and, I don't know, the car's gone from the driveway. I mean, it's like almost anything can start us off on this spiral of experience. And our first reaction is kind of either shock or surprise, delight, you know, depending on what it is. But we immediately begin to go into explaining what does this mean, because we are compelled neurologically to take life experience and start putting it into a stream of words almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So a societal event for us was 9/11. I mean, it was a huge to watch our whole country deal with something that we had not anticipated.
Right.
So it shocked us. It shocked us individually, and it shocked us as a collective society. And immediately, we start looking for the story. And the first story that emerges is the survivor story. And this is true of every event. But it's so obvious in this, you know, that as people stumbled out of the buildings, talked about being in New York, whatever, that there's the survivor's tale. And it's a very dramatic, raw, oh, my God, I'm alive kind of tale. But what really interests me now is within a year, people were publishing books about what it was like. One husband who kept a diary of his wife's long and arduous recovery. Now there are books of several of the widows of men who were killed in the building and what they have done. I mean, they've gone over to Afghanistan and built schools for girls. You know, and huge choices of what to do once you're through the survivor's story, then you get down into the story of integration and new meaning.
Mm.
And that is the really rich territory. And that is the territory that is often the most moving to us. We have that kind of adrenaline empathy that occurs with the survivor tale. But the real writing is in the integration story.
So interesting. I should mention to our listeners that Christina's website, storycatcher.net, is filled with so many wonderful resources, as is this book. So sadly, we're right at about time. Any last sentence advice for?
Well,
for
I think writers know this. Writers are already attached to story, but I think that we have to stay connected now in the pace and rush of modern life. We must not lose our connection to narrative. It takes a little longer to tell a story than to send a text message. But it's a profound experience that has made us who we are, is our story. And I think we lose it at our peril.
Mm, great, yeah. So true. So true. Great advice. Christina, thanks for taking the time this morning.
I always love to talk about story, Marie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. That was Christina Baldwin, author of Story Catcher, Making Sense of Our Lives Through the Power and Practice of Story. Available now and published by New World Library. A quote from William Saroyan will take us out this morning. The most solid advice for a writer is this, I think. Try to learn to breathe deeply. Really to taste food when you eat, and when you sleep, really to sleep. Try as much as possible to be wholly alive with all your might, and when you laugh, laugh like hell, and when you get angry, get good and angry. Try to be alive. You'll be dead soon enough. On that cheery note, Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.
You and her. I just don't wanna be free.